I have a confession to make. I'm having quite a difficult shifting immediately from the Bible study that we have that is real, just walking with me, every vein, every hair, every part of me. And coming directly to a new subject immediately is quite difficult for me. And I wanted to make that confession so that you're with me and know where I am. Completely confused. Because I want to stay longer with that Bible study. Because I feel that Bible study that we have in the morning, if I had to come just for one thing and hold it, I knew I would still come for that Bible study.
Yeah. Yes.
It really is an ascending Bible study that just tells me, who am I? What am I doing within my own context, within my own community? And I have that difficulty of shifting. But let's try and shift together to Africa. So I come from me to our continent, Africa, which is our subject today and for the new people. Yesterday we dealt with something about gospel and culture, and today we shift to look at the continent of Africa. Africa is my continent, and I hold hope high for Africa. I mean, so much that speaks otherwise. If you live on the continent of Africa, or if you have connections with Africa, there is so much that floods with hopelessness on our continent. And so what I want to bring to you today is to bring to you my continent, our continent, Africa, as we see it. The word hope is always ambiguous. It is ambiguous in many languages because it, in one way, refers to both the activity of hoping and that which is hoped for. Thus, hope is a word which on the one hand sets us off with flashing amber lights warning, beware, barriers ahead. There's that aspect in the word hope. But on the other hand, it encourages with the assurance to hope, meaning not to give up, to keep going on, and to have that kind of trust that we've had in the Bible study that there is someone beyond who is holding their arms up and saying, you may even fall on these arms, I will be able to pick you up. This is how I would like to present our continent, Africa. I present it with hope because for those of us that live in that country and have embraced the Christian faith, we live by hope because hope is a central theme of the Bible and a major tenet of the Christian faith. For us as African Christians, and I think for Christian sisters and brothers everywhere in every community, hope is an expectation which is very closely linked to faith. We do not hope for what we have, but rather for what we long for. Paul, when writing to the Christians of Romans, said in Romans 8:24, now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. This is what gives us the strength to live and go on as Christians in Africa, being invited by hope to be radical in nature, to risk resisting hopelessness. That, I think, is the tenet on which we have to live on our continent. Sometimes, even when the situations look like they invite us to otherwise, to simply say, no, I am not going to give up the hope that is grounded in the faith which is supported by the incarnation of Jesus Christ. So let me give a little bit of how our continent is in Africa presently. We find ourselves from time to time dismayed by the rising statistics of poverty on our continent, by the lower per capita income leading to families not able to support themselves, poor health, maternal and infant mortality, rising illiteracy, and endless wars. I am sure that for those of us that read in the internet, in the newspapers, or through the TV, when the TV opens and Africa is on, you wonder if there are still any people who are alive on that continent. And sometimes probably you wonder if there are any people of goodwill on that continent. I have been able to look at the news media from living in a foreign country. Either when we lived here on this continent when Idi Amin was the ruler of Uganda. And every time we got out of our apartment into the outside, people would say, "So you come from that country of Idi Amin?" And that question was asked over and over and over again. And today, as we travel in our ministry, both my husband and I, to various countries of Europe, here in North America, our own continent in Africa, Asia, or South and Central America, the frequent questions that are often asked is Rwanda. I think everybody knows the story of Rwanda. We don't need to retell it, because people remember the bodies they have seen flowing in the rivers of our continent. People will talk to us about Liberia, because I think everybody in their living rooms has seen what the situation in Liberia has been. People have seen the child soldiers that have been created by the conditions of war in our continent, carrying big guns that are not manufactured on our continent, but have found a home on our continent, a safe home that is destroyed life of just an immense human life that has been lost on our continent. People will talk to us about Somalia. You on this soil know about Somalia, because the American people were very much involved also through the sending of the soldiers to Somalia. And therefore, once there's that connection, then you get even more news about that particular place than when there isn't an American connection. It's like when you watch the athletes being in any game and you are in a particular country that has athletes there, you seem to think that it's only the athletes of that country that are competing. This is also the same with the news about when we are interlinked with news. People often ask us much more about the AIDS, the situation, even on the questions of health. Because in the media, part of the things that also people have heard a lot is the question of AIDS. And people tell us, is every other person in Africa suffering from AIDS? Is the church really going to live? Is there going to be any single person who is still alive on this continent by the next 10 or 20 years? Won't everybody die from AIDS? This is another question where the mass media has really made a big publicity on the continent. And when on the Bible studies, the sister leading said of this particular person who has been in Bosnia and in Rwanda, saying, "You don't know the story." I think I felt from the many stories that I hear of people who are coming from various places that either are in war-torn zones or are situations that are also quite infected with AIDS. They say, yes, people do not die. Yes, there is a problem, but sometimes the problem is not the way that it's being told by the mass media. They say, sit and think through why the mass media presents the story in that particular way. These are some of the things, but there are also other things that confront our continent that really are painful to us. On the one hand, there's the economic mismanagement and undemocratic political systems. On the other hand, there's the debt crisis and the unfair trade policies which hinder progress and affect the way things are done on our continent, Africa. All these realities with terrible consequences for human beings, the millions orphan fed children. The number of women who die from pregnancy in Africa is the highest in the whole world, just from pregnancy, simply because they have not been able to get the prenatal health care that is needed. The hundreds and thousands of unemployed youth who often have to migrate from the rural areas into the cities to look for work, and in so doing, the immense people coming into the cities without the infrastructure of providing the shelter within that city, the housing within that city that is affordable, including for those people that do not have high employment. This is creating something that is only a few years old in Africa, slums. The question of slums is not really our original way. It's slums have come in into the cities because of the movements into the cities. If you are in the rural areas in Africa, you will find that life is quite different. And you need to make a distinction on how one views poverty when you are in Africa in an urban situation as compared to in a rural situation. Those of us that come from rural situation often do not really understand the description that is given to us as being poor. When you are living in a house that is around, hut thatched with grass, you grow food for yourself, you go to worship in a community church or under a tree, you are happy when somebody is sick, you are able to go in and help the person who is sick by carrying water on the head. The concept of poverty within those communities is not there until someone else comes and tells them, you are poor. But the concept of poverty for us comes when we are in a situation that the human dignity does not exist, and the slum situations in our city, in our city areas, are some of these that help us to define what really poverty means in our situations. The other parts in the rural areas is when we have what we also face in our continent. Again, the Bible study this morning really was so important to me when our leader once again was able to refer to the situation in her own life from one illness to the next. We on the continent of Africa usually ask, why do we have to have so many natural disasters in addition to what we have? What do we need drought for? And yet, drought is one of the most common natural disaster that we have on the continent. And when we have drought, then people cannot plant food. And then they cannot support themselves. And then in the rural areas too, we begin to face what we might call the poverty, the undignified life. Because then people have either to migrate to a place where they will be able to find a possibility to live, or else we see the cattle, we see the wildlife, which is one of our very important heritage, disappearing from us. We see the possibility of people not being able to support themselves. And there we really see the concept of poverty in those areas. The other question is, some of the things that cause our continent to feature so much on the news is what is usually, is our connection with development agencies, some of which are churches, some of which are non-governmental organizations. Where here, the Africa is a very favored continent when it comes to this connection with development people. But we are constantly in dilemma on how to view this help that we have from outside in the name of the development, because it comes in many forms. The church is always part of this. In some ways it comes in terms of we want this continent to change. And so the way we want this continent to change is we want it to be mechanized. We want it to be hooked to the internet. We want it to be hooked to the telephones, etc. And presently, many people on the continent of Africa ask, is this really the foremost? Is this what we need first? Much of what is passed for the development is usually made under the name of a project, a particular project that will be supported by a particular group. And that project is viewed from the concept that the people who are supporting the development project have in mind. Mm-hmm. Not the particular community where they live and how they define it, how they define what their needs are. This concept of project help for the development sometimes has kept the place much more underdeveloped and much more dependent on outside help. So one of the biggest problems that we have on the continent of Africa is dependency on outside help. The church is not innocent in forming part of this dependency. Non-governmental organizations as well as corporations and governments have caused quite a bit of this dependence among some communities in such a way that those communities which have had this kind of connection for long enough come to a point where they almost feel that they are not able to do anything on their own until they have outside help. And this is a very, very bad situation for anyone to find themselves in. So what we are asking today in Africa is, might the crisis that we face on the continent force us now to rethink a different way of going? In the church, these debates are quite strong. People are beginning to ask new questions on the continent. We said that we wanted to have this as a debate together because we know that from any good historian who tells any story of a people will have to accept that they tell it from the point of view of where they are. What has shaped them from getting those particular information? What is the background of where they are coming from? And how they feel from inside in interpreting the facts that are given to them. For example, if Pharaoh had been asked when the Jewish people left in what we have come to also claim as our own story, the story of the Exodus, as the story of salvation, I think if Pharaoh, the Egyptians, would have been asked what really happened, they wouldn't have said God has saved these people and they have gone to the other land. Perhaps they would have said something like a few Hebrew slaves just escaped and we continued with our life as it is. Probably something like that. So we wanted to open this and just have some debate with you because of two reasons. We are Africans ourselves. We have lived on this continent for most of our lives. We go back to this continent very frequently. We hear the information from, right now as we work, we call ourselves missionaries abroad, and we want to claim this word because it's a word that has been denied to us, we who are from Africa. Even when you are abroad doing the word of God, spreading, letting people share your story and the story of Jesus Christ, we are never so named as missionaries because this is a word that is seen as people coming to us or to other lands. But we claim it because we feel we are part of the community that has been sent by the word of God. So we see our role now as a role of missionaries, sharing the story of our continent with the rest of the global church where we encounter others and hearing their story and all of us putting this story together to form the community that we should be, the community that is saved by the word of Jesus Christ. We are searching for something that I have called in a new book that just came out last week that I have helped to put together in search of a round table. I really like this image here, that we can sit around, searching together a way in which we can be a community such that a continent such as ours, that people often look at with only pity, sometimes exhaustion, oh, we've given so much to this continent and nothing is happening. In Europe, we hear this quite a lot, the donor exhaustion, because we've been seen as a continent to be given. We've raised so much money in our mission work to Africa, but nothing is happening. This is something that the donor exhaustion. The other aspect that we hear is people who depend only on the news that they have heard from the media feel that the problems are so big that we have nothing we can do. The other very common statement we hear is that let them solve their own problems. If they can't get their act together, why should we be involved? The other common thing we hear, especially from the economists today, Many of the economists will say that Africa doesn't matter any longer to the world economy. And if you remove this continent and just throw it out, the world will still continue anyway, because Africa contributes nothing to the world economy. Presently, we have heard this in as international meetings, as the closing during the debates that were ending the GATT, you know, the discussions that were happening to put back what is now the new organization, the new organization,
World Trade Organization.
And there are many people stated in the public forum we could hear from Geneva. Africa doesn't matter. And sometimes you have read the whole economic reports that have been given and not a single mention of Africa, because the continent doesn't matter. And I have heard somebody say if Africa disappeared into the sea, nobody would even notice. Nobody would even notice. So we bring these debates here because we want to share our experience from a different way. We want to share our experience that tells you that actually, in the face of what looks as hopelessness, this is not really what we know of our continent. Not everybody's dead on the continent. There are many living, active people doing important things on the continent. Communities of small indigenous to the soil people who are working to change the situations. When you hear, for example, what recently happened in former Zaire, of people saying, no, we don't want Mobutu, you must hear the voice of Africans saying, we are conscious of dictatorship. We are conscious of bad governments. We are conscious of people being left out of the management of our own continent, and we want to see a change into this. You cannot hear this message if the attitude that has been formed on a particular people on a particular continent doesn't allow you to see the positive aspect of what is happening. Because what happens when there is the situation like Zaire, and many people will hear, I will say, there goes another war in Africa. But they won't say, there goes another people's movements who want change in Africa. And sometimes when that change comes, there is of course some loss of life. A seed must die. A grain of wheat, somebody wrote a novel by the title A Grain of Wheat, using the scripture in my country, the scriptural message that a seed must die. And in our Christian story, we have received a good message because someone died for us. So sometimes there is a loss of life simply because people have been looking for other different alternatives. It is sad, it's not a good thing to do. But I think one needs to read beyond what we see as just another war, as really a people's movement. In our country, Kenya, today, if you've been following news, which I think many of you have been following, you will hear a new political unrest in our country. It's not that new. We do have political problems in our country, again, based on similar feeling and knowing of the people in our country, that we need to have a kind of system that allows for more voices to have a part on the decision-making table. This is not happening in a sufficient enough way, and people are saying that we need change. It's not isolated mass protest in a particular place, but it is people in different parts of small towns, small places in our country that are beginning to say, no, we need to reform our laws so they are more democratic. We need to change the rules of electing our leaders so that they are more democratic. And here the church in Kenya is one of the most loud spoken group of people. Both the Protestant and the Catholic churches. They have taken the liberty to go and speak to the government leaders. They write it in the papers and they organize in the communities civil education. Now what is happening is that the government leaders do not want their civil education to be given to the people, because they would like the ignorance to continue so that they can continue to apply what they wish to see as something that is a privilege to themselves only as the leaders. The church says no. If the people have to vote wisely, then the people need to know why we elect the leaders. The people need to know, before they obey the authority of the leaders, whether the leaders themselves understand what kind of authority has been given to them in the position that they have been given as leaders. And so the churches in Africa, this is one of the biggest problems of the churches in Africa. Program. Civil education is one of the biggest programs of the churches in Africa. It happens through the National Councils of Churches. It happens through individual churches. It happens through small groups. Churches are also taking part in the monitoring of elections when they happen. They ask the ecumenical movement globally, and they ask other people who are outside the continent to also come and help to observe the elections. The reason for this is that when you also have the outside community, including the church abroad, it is easier for the local church not only to be pointed out, because sometimes the governments, our governments, associate the local church with the opposition parties. So they see the church simply as an opposition. And the statement that you are a church, you should not be involved in politics is very common from our leaders, simply because they do not like to have a challenge from the churches. But the churches say, our faith sends us out. Our faith commands us to also be part of building the political systems that are just and fair, that will be able to create possibilities for peace. Because when you do not have political systems that are just and fair, then you do not expect the peace to be there. Peace and righteousness. Righteousness and peace, in many of the scriptures that we read, always go together as pairs. Righteousness, justice, and peace. And you just don't get over, put peace on top as a topping on a cake that has been made. So the churches are very strong on this. And this is part of our hope on the continent, where we would be a salt that is mixed with the whole food and not a sugar coating on top. Political action is seen by many of us who are inside the church as a calling to which we cannot stay back and just wait until when we have a problem and then be involved in bringing the band-aid, the first aid that is necessary, that is needed. Another area that the church is very much concerned with in Africa is rereading the Bible with different eyes. Rereading the Bible with African eyes. Rereading the Bible with the eyes of those people that do not have a lot of illiteracy. Reading the Bible for many of us also as African women, not only women, but African women. There is a point to this. The Bible is our global, our gift to the whole church. And indeed, we are one as the church. And we need to hear the message that Jesus is calling us as communities responsible to one another. But I think we also need to hear that message from where we are standing at a particular time in history. How is this rereading the Bible done by different groups? When we read the Bibles in earlier years, I will give an example. When we read the Bibles in earlier years, we probably would have heard the message, "Blessed are the poor," quite differently, because we are blessed, we are poor in many of our situations when we compare to what the world is happening. Sometimes a passage such as that can be made to sound only inside the church by the sense of the poor in the spirit, right? The poor in the spirit. And that too is very good to stay with. we all need the mercy of God. But I think what I hear now when I visit communities back, and I have worked specifically in the area of the Bible for the longest time of my working in Africa, what I hear the people try to do is to try to hear this message now in different ways. There's a group in South Africa who are doing contextual theology. And what they have tried to do when they read particular passages is to explore it with what does it mean for, what is this message, what is it saying, what did it say to the people at that particular time, what does it say to us living here and now for this particular time, and what does it say to us in the context of the global church, what does it say in the context of the global church. Last year, I was invited by the Anglican Church in my country to a very small village in a diocese in the western part of Kenya to spend a week with the women of that church reading the Bible together with them and doing Bible studies in there every day with them for a week. In that particular community. And when it's very interesting that when I'm doing Bible studies in a Western community, I always go with all my Bible studies prepared and the text, and I carry with me the commentaries just in case I need to refer, etc. And this is the way the Western training has given me. I was trained in this country, and this is the way that I have come to also presenting the Bible studies in places in the West. When I went back home from the US and I started to work with the United Bible Societies, I changed the method, and I will tell you why I changed, and I tell you about this community that I have introduced and what the work that I did with them to illustrate the Bible in the context of Africa. I went into the job of Bible translation and found I was working with colleagues who were from the West, all of them at that level, because the United Bible Society had put a very high requirement for the people who train Bible translators. You have to be trained in theology or biblical studies or linguistics up to PhD level to get that job. Secondly, you have to have another, if you're trained in theology, you need to spend at least a year in linguistics. If you're trained in linguistics, you need to spend at least a year in theology, etc. And for many years that the United Bible Societies has stayed in Africa, people who had those qualifications usually were taken by the universities and seminaries in our own continent, and they did not join the United Bible Society, the Africans. So the team that worked on Bible translation was always the team of people from the West, Europeans and North Americans mainly. The second aspect at that level, it was all men. And at that level, because this job involved a lot of traveling on the continent. And traveling in Africa is not as easy as traveling here in the United States. Even coming to Holden is quite easy. You just get on something and then you get to Chelan and you get brought here and then there's a school bus that brings you here. Big deal or no? And you don't even have delays. When we go back at home, to travel in Africa is not that easy. Sometimes you have one flight a week that takes you to a particular situation within one place of Africa. And sometimes that flight gets cancelled. And sometimes that plane needs to be serviced so it doesn't come, or it comes and they tell you, well, we just discovered we are missing one screw or one nut and we have to ground this plane. So you wait for the next plane. Or you sometimes have to go walking, etc., on the roads, etc. So many women were not encouraged to take this job, but many men took it, but they had families and the women looked after the families. So when I joined this group of brothers to work on the continent of Africa in Bible translation, we used to travel together to different places. The African church receives us, who are also men, bishops, and evangelists and main Bible translators. And we work together very well. We work together very well. In the evening, the men are together making talk. And I seem to be very odd in that group. So I would, like, the bishop would take me to stay with his wife. And I would say, you know, trained in the United States and having been also introduced to a feminist way of thinking in the United States, they don't realize I have just as much education as they have. And why am I the one who is left out, this kind of thing? Why am I the one who is left out of the evening where the decisions are made, you know, where the decisions are made? And I felt very frustrated in the beginning. And then I thought to myself, what am I saying? Am I saying that spending my time with the evangelist's wife or the bishop's wife is not profitable? How stupid am I? Am I saying spending time with a fellow sister is not useful? I thought, well, I need to rethink this training of mine, that you need to spend time with the people who have got the same education with you. And I started to enjoy, and I stayed with the women. And I started to work with women on Bible, on the Bible work, trying to see whether they know what is happening in the translation and to do Bible studies together with them. And I learned a new way of how the women were reading the Bible. They taught me anew. They put me back into a training, into a new university. And I think this is now what I use a lot more because it is proper within my context. So I don't prepare beforehand the particular text that we will do until I get to the community together with the community. In this particular group that I was invited, the week that I went to Africa, I asked them, what book do you want us to study together? And they said, we want to study the book of Ruth. So we brought the book of Ruth. I said, how do you want us to study the book of Ruth? And they said, we want to study the book. You help us to understand the book of Ruth. And I said, yes, let's help each other to understand the book of Ruth. And then we made some community talk about different things, about the book of Ruth and about our lives. And then we decided that the way that would suit us best was to study the book of Ruth by dividing ourselves into groups according to the characters that they are in the book of Ruth. So there was the group of Naomi's and Orpah's and Boaz and every character that you have in Ruth. And they went to work. They read, the person who could read the scriptures loud, and they tried to make out what this story is, how this person is speaking to them individually. They came back to, and we agreed that they would report in the way that they wanted to report. Each of them would report in the way they wanted to report. I was supposed to be the consultant, sitting here with my Bibles and all commentaries in case they ask questions that needed to be referred into those books. When they came back to report the groups, by the way, before that, no one came to me to ask me, what does this passage mean in the original? How do we interpret this passage? But they came to ask me different things, and this is what I want you to notice. They say it to us. They say it to me, we want to be able to come to present Ruth in the church because we were using the church. We want to present this. Is it okay if we come let me pick one character, Ruth. Boaz. They said, we think Boaz was a polygamist. Is it okay if we can say that in the church? Sure. I asked them, why do you think Boaz was a polygamist, being such an elderly man and so rich with so many things in his own chamber? Shamba is the word for farm. And he could easily have been a polygamist. Ruth may have been his second wife. So I said, what are you driving at? And they said, we want to be able to try and say, how come this Ruth, who is an ancestor of Jesus, might have passed through a polygamous marriage? And polygamy is not a good thing. So how does God use people who have not such good histories? Yeah. How does God use people who don't have such good histories? that Ruth could come through that system. We want to be able to, we want to. And they said to me, Orpah, we don't know enough about her story. And she didn't come along with Ruth. And they said, we want to, they asked me, do you think Orpah did not come along with Ruth because he did not want to follow the tradition? And I asked why. They said, you see, Ruth did exactly what is expected of our culture. You go with your mother-in-law, because the culture says once you get married to someone, it doesn't matter whether they are alive or not, you're married into a community, into the family. This is not usually the way that this story is read in the West. They say Ruth was the ordinary person. She went with her mother-in-law, she went into a polygamous marriage, and this is what happened with her. But Orpah seems to be saying no to sometimes what the these were the younger women, what the traditions teach us. Mm-hmm. She's saying, no, I don't really want to go. I don't really want to go to this. I want to do something different. And how does one do something different where the culture tells you to do something this way? And then they talked about various things that they thought could be happening. They were able to pick up the violence of the, you know, in that story, it's told of Boaz, that Boaz's workers would be violent to Ruth. So Boaz tells the workers not to be violent to Ruth. So they picked up the issue of violence and talked quite a lot about the issue of violence. They picked up the issue of refugees, which is quite strong in our country, that this family of Elimelech were refugees in other places, and they were able to reconstruct what it might have meant to them, etc. Now, why do I bring just this example of reading the Bible, people reading the Bible according to the context in which they are? The issues, after they had picked up all these issues, violence, refugees, going to live into another country, having to learn their languages, marrying their death, they stayed with the issue of the death. Death is common in our places. Then they were able to say, what happens to you when you lose all your three children? What happens to you when you are a refugee? What do we do about the situation of war? What is happening to our continent with refugees? Then reading the story in this way, the church beginning to read the story in this way, the church identifying Jesus as having also been a refugee, begins to deal with those things as we are not the cursed continent, but we are a continent that God is closest to, a continent of hope, a continent where we don't have what we really would like to be, but a continent which we are striving towards somewhere. And the scriptures make sense to us because they tell our story. They tell it from every point of issue that inflicts and conflicts with us. Let me stop here and open this for some more discussion. I have talked probably longer than I expected to talk. But this is how we are facing, rereading the scriptures, facing our reality with courage, admitting that we have problems. Yes, we must admit that we have problems. But we don't see these problems as defining us as the evil people. We see ourselves as the people that Christ died for. We admit that the human needs Christ because sin is in us. But we don't see ourselves as a people that are outcast, as sometimes we are seen to be. And we don't see ourselves as a people who don't matter, who would drop into the sea and the God above wouldn't notice that we have dropped into the sea. Thank you. Yes.
I don't want to get way off the subject because there's, you know, 50, you know, you've said lots of things. But you, if I understood you, you commented about we missionaries in your country need to, like, which we're all doing, getting to the 21st century, have to start coming around to. And I, if I understood you, let's say, for example, I met the country, the continent. I think you said we need to change our style. For is that? And I wondered what you could say, and you know, t- 2 minutes or less of some ideas of what you have about how we Westerners going in there and wanting to make you like us, what we could do differently in the 21st century, let's say education. Is that what you're trying to say to us?
Yes. Other things? Yes, that's one of the things that I'm saying. I think for anyone who is doing mission in any context, anywhere in the world today, needs to do mission in a different way. I think when mission is seen as going out there to do this and change these people and bring them into, I think there is something that is lacking there because it goes with the superiority complex.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that one of the most difficult things to deal with is a superiority complex in all of us at different times. There is always somebody that one considers inferior in their own inner self. And I think it's a difficult issue to deal with because it's difficult to admit that it is there for each one of us where it is. And sometimes it is so reared and so nurtured under different cover terms that we don't even notice it, or neither are we willing to think and stay with it long enough to see the superiority complex in us. And I think that is one of the problems of the way that mission has been approached. I am appreciative to the way that many missionaries have really given their life to places where they have gone and introduced the word of God there. That I'm not necessarily critical of, but I'm critical of the attitude sometimes to the people. Every missionary who goes abroad should think of themselves, he or she, as an exchange Christian person from one community to another, going there to give something of the community where she or he comes from and to learn something from that community where they are going. And if that missionary goes with a particular skill that is needed in that community, that missionary should think of working herself or himself out of work and moving on to something else. I think that any missionary who feels that they need to go to the place and their whole lifetime is to keep on that skill, any missionary for me today who goes to a place and within 5 years they couldn't be replaced, needs to ask themselves. We should not make ourselves, and this is the same with us as missionaries in different places, including our own communities. I think it's not a pointing of a finger, but a communities when they are made to become so dependent. One of the things you should notice with a missionary question is that our churches have got create some of this. And the reason is this: we don't have the resources to pay many of the church workers in our own churches. So what we do is we say, send a missionary because you will pay the missionary, okay? So it is also an easy way for our churches to find workers that are needed with the paycheck coming along with it. But the challenge there is that, can you sometimes tell our churches, do you think that, yes, if we send a missionary, it will cost us $100. I understand that in your church, you could be able to get 10 people doing the same work for the $100. How about if you really promise us that those $100 you could use it for the people there? It would make a difference because our churches would begin to think differently. But if you do that, then you need to follow both the accountability issues, both from ourselves and from yourselves in a different way.
I had spent all time in Africa, and the thing I was impressed with, and in a way almost shocked with, was the tribal attitude. Mm-hmm. In that, like, I was in Tanzania, and I was working with a Boeing company there, and there was one stewardess, and she said, "Oh, those colorful niggers are no good. Us up in Arusha are good." You know? My gosh, and another one, I was teaching, I said, "This fellow is a good electrician. He'll go places." "Oh, no, he won't, because he's not of the same tribe as the leader." Mm-hmm. And how is that being addressed? Is the church working on that? Mm-hmm. To me, the whole thing in Africa, they need Christ, it's like nobody's business. And is something to be done about that? What is your hope along that line?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Or
Americans,
too.
Yes, we do.
Badly.
Yeah, not, mm-hmm. No, not like it was in Africa when I was there.
So secular, mm-hmm. Embarrassing.
Yeah. Not secular, tribal.
No, America.
I wish the debate could be louder because it would benefit for you.
I'm saying Africa was tribal, she's saying we're secular. I said there's two different things.
No, you didn't mean it. I'm sorry. I guess I'll have to speak.
Okay.
You like, we all say things because we have so much in our heads. You said Africa really needs missionaries.
I said Africa needs Christ.
Okay, but different. I think America is in real trouble. That's why I had to speak up. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they need Christ too.
Hardly. I wouldn't disagree that Africa needs Christ. I think we need Christ.
Oh, yeah.
I hope you do too. But we do need Christ. That's, I think, something I would like to affirm. Mm-hmm. The question of tribalism is a question that I need not also necessarily disagree with. Yesterday, my husband and I were making a joke with a group we had on the teaching staff. We said to the teaching staff, we come from enemy tribes. And you know, it's true. My husband and I don't speak each other's language. Our particular people didn't have any contact with each other. And when I was going to marry him, my father, who has been in many, many places, had no qualms. He didn't just saw him as himself. But when I went back to my own community, they said, what a loss. How can we raise our own to go to such a different place? And when I go to his family too, there are people who think otherwise, but his father-in-law perhaps has been my best love. My father-in-law, his father, until he died recently. But many of the families, what happens is that when families are and people are in contact with each other, the myths that they develop on one another very often get dissolved, because our two families and several other people, we're not even unique, don't see anything in our own communities. But this is a myth that was held before, long time ago. But you could take a situation like Rwanda, and you could make a big case of tribalism there because of the ethnic conflict that they are, which I hope that you do the same when you are talking about the situation on Bosnia, you know, and see that as tribalism as well. Because there's no, if you shift the situations, there's really no difference. I think what is wrong in some of the analysis is that very often what happens in Africa, which I do not deny, is seen as being more evil than what happens elsewhere. And I think that we need to look at ourselves and say, what are we saying? Are we saying, Bishop Tutu, I have an article here by Bishop Tutu, who has addressed this issue. Is the Christian community, is the world, is everybody thinking that we are intrinsically, black people, Africans are intrinsically sinful to such an extent that they're different from anyone else? Mm-hmm. And Bishop Tutu was trying to address this and say, when we stand at that, that's where we should be asking ourselves, what are we saying when we look at that? There is tribalism, there is favoritism. Sometimes I see it in different ways in Europe, but because it has not been so named, people don't often talk about it. But I see it in terms of leadership in place X, which I won't mention, in Geneva. The leader of that place is from one of the Scandinavian tribes. And I see when they want to do publishing material and they want to do videos, when he needed an assistant, he got it from the Scandinavian tribe that they come from, got the video director, etc. And if that was transcribed into my own country, it would be seen as tribalism, but it was simply seen as these are the people that I knew best. Very often our people say the same. They think that those are the people that they knew best. If in Africa, when Kennedy asked his brother to be, when he was as a president, and his brother was the attorney general, if it had been in Africa, it would have been seen as a big tribalism. So these things do happen here. When in this country you have an election and then the person, the head of the state, has to choose who they want, and very often they choose their friends, because your community is different now. Because your community is not based on people who speak the same language, who have the same cultural roots. but rather people who have grown to college together, for example, to the seminary together, to live in a particular place. So your tribalism exists, but it's defined differently. Our tribalism is defined on linguistic groups and on a cultural affiliation. And so you find a government where the person has been able to bring in their contemporaries. It is a similar type of thing, but it's differently named. It's not right.
What do they like to say? I agree. There's a lot of what is called favoritism, nepotism here in the United States. But we are all under one law. And so therefore, even though we have favorites under that, we're still the one constitution, the one law. And look at their, what's his name, get kicked out of office, President Nixon.
Nixon.
Even the very president, by law, yes. He got kicked out because there was one law. Even though he presented a tremendous tribalism, he tried to protect the people under him who did wrong. Mm-hmm. And yes, that's tribalism, I agree. But it was under one law, and yes. That's not, well, it seems, what I've seen in Africa, each tribe, and they're, maybe it's not the right way, each group has their own law. Mm-hmm. And so this law don't meet. This guy can kill that guy can kill this guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the key issue here is what we need to look at is, there's a concept of the nation state.
Nation state.
We are in an evolutionary time. Because if you look back at history, the type of states that we have at the moment, and I think one of the, for me personally, the disaster really was at the time of independence, the borders as we have them today, all the governments agreed these are holy cows. You know, the borders shall remain sacred, they will not be touched. Mm-hmm. But these borders were drawn, putting people together that probably had no relationship.
Yes. Well, I believe a lot of the trouble.
So then you find yourself, you have now to find what is it that you have in common, what is it that you can be able to evolve as a nation.
Yeah.
Now, and I think that is a struggle that we are involved in. And what is now happening, people are now re-examining that.
Yeah.
You know, what happened at the time of independence and the type of nations that we got, what changes did they make? Yes. Probably no changes. You just had the same type of divide and a rule system which had been established to serve the people who were rulers.
Yeah.
At that time, you just put a black person there, but continue with the same divide and rule, benevolent, despotic type of leadership.
Uh-huh.
Now, that is what now people are re-examining now. What is it? If we say we are in Kenya, and there are 42 different groups.
Yeah.
Now, what does it mean if we are going to evolve finally as a nation and share together?
Yeah.
So you'll find, and I'm glad you brought that example, because it's very common. If I apply for a job, and you apply for the job,
mm-hmm.
Say I get the job, and probably the people who are interviewed, majority of them are probably from my ethical group. So there is a bigger temptation to say, look, I got the job because I was safe and because of my tribal background. So it's the whole question of civic education for us to understand our own responsibility and to be able to understand, look, if we are providing either facilities and sharing of facilities and economic opportunities, that these economic opportunities are shared on the basis of accepted rules, other than on the basis of favoritism,
mm-hmm.
so that you have accountability in terms of governance
and
decision making. That is really the issue. And for me, the issue of tribalism, there is a lot of merit in diversity. And if for anything else, I think this country is one of the countries that probably demonstrates that you are such a big, varied, varied country with people from of different, who have come from different countries. And so if you can take a place even in Kenya, so you have people who have different skills. She just made a joke at the beginning. The community I come from, we tended to be more agriculture oriented.
Mm-hmm.
much more. They say we are ruined by money at the beginning, so we tended to be more involved in commerce. And a lot of our own people in the community, that is a special skill that they have. But others have also other different skills.
Yeah.
So it's so how we share and how we participate in proper governance. I think that's really the key issue.
Yeah.
But we will continue as long as we have few opportunities. And you have, poverty, you know, in terms of relativity, whether it is rural or whether it's urban.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had a little bit more time, we could have looked at, you know, this whole question in Rwanda. Because if you see the problem in Rwanda, really, that problem is really the ethical issue. Is something that has been played on. That is really not a fundamental factor. It has been used, it was used, and heightened up to be able to keep the country under control. And then people perfected it. And you see, the government that was, the president died, was killed in 1994, which led to the genocide. Now, they had perfected a system of annihilation of a people, and not just themselves, anyone who disagreed with them, whether they were people from the present tribe, but were in the opposition. So everybody suffered, whether they, so it's, and we got a type of leadership, and that is the, I think that's the disaster we got. We developed a leadership in many of our countries after independence, which became just absolute dictators. And it did not matter whether you belong to their tribe or not. If you are not, as they, we are told in Kenya, if you don't sing my song, and then you are not with me, and if you are not with me, you are finished.
Yeah.
It did not matter whether you are the relative of the president or not. But the tribe is it's been a key factor in terms of then people saying, look, you belong to our tribe, so don't agree with the other, you follow me blindly. But it's an issue that...
Well, I think one of the biggest problems that Africa has is the way the us, the whites, dropped you in independence. They did not train very much of the people to be leaders, to set it up. And they just walked out. That wasn't in the Congo. The Belgians walked out, even took the police uniforms with them. I mean, my gosh, that's terrible. And I think they set you up to be hit, you might say, because they took a continent and people that got along fine in their own villages, what have you, and they tried to make a nation out of it, cutting through the middle of villages with their boundaries, as you said, and then they said, oh, independence is a great thing, and just walked out and left without setting things up.
And even the people who were educated, so-called prepared, prepared to take those jobs. You know, they were prepared to continue the system which was in place.
Yeah.
At the time of colonialism.
Yeah.
In order to change.
Yeah. And then you
and that system established to serve somebody else.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
But that is the mentality. That's why we were prepared. And it's taken us a long time to realize that, you know, it was in serving the people.
Yeah.
It was serving somebody else. So even up to today, it has continued serving a small clique, say, of Kenyans or Rwandans or Zambians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're all familiar with the Pedagogy of the Oppressed. The book of the recent writer just died recently. The Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Yes.
Yes?
No.
The Pedagogy of the Oppressed was written by Paul Freire.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he says there applies to us and applies to many communities globally. If you have an oppressed people, when they get out of the oppression, even if they are the ones who have been in the front line, it's quite easy for them to get into becoming the oppressors, because they step right into the feet of the oppressed.
Yeah.
They have been longing for those privileges so much that when they get there, they don't remember why they were fighting for those privileges.
Yeah.
And we have a bit of that occurring in Africa. And I think when we come probably this second go around, where we celebrated independence so highly,
mm-hmm.
We enjoyed part of it at the beginning. Presently, we are at a place where we don't enjoy our independence anymore. We are rethinking our independence, and now we probably get independent from ourselves. And then we begin to do a different way of looking at our own continent. Yes. We want to recommend two books that are very interesting and useful that can help see also Africa within the context of what is happening elsewhere. This is important for really being objective. They are both very new books. One is Ethnic Conflicts and Religion, Challenges to the Churches. There's an article there on the Rwanda situation that is just very well written. But it also has Bosnia, it has Palestine, it has Fiji, it has several other places. So one can see different kinds of island and so on. Different things of ethnic conflicts and how religion plays part of it. It's just come out, so it's new. The other one is The Reconciliation of Peoples, Challenges to the Churches. And here again, it picks up some of those issues where there have been conflict, including the South African situation, and examines things like the Truth Commission, for example. I think this is one of the things you must see us coming out of the Africa soil, of Africa doing something, not just to bound the wounds as they have been and let the answer, you know, start to show, but really to reopen it so that it can be scraped, the badness can be scraped away. Some people see it as just bringing the wound, you know, exposing it. But I think that in that way of people dealing with what has been injustice, probably the South African people might come out better than where in our own countries where we have gotten independence and did not look at the areas of injustices that happened during that fight. Yeah. And that is also a little bit exposed in this new book. But you should see those things as coming out of the Africans. The whole Truth Commission is not something that has been brought to the people of South Africa because of the West, but it's something that Mandela and his people are beginning to deal with. And I think it is a learning to the rest of the world. It has to be seen as an African contribution on how to deal with difficult situations. I think Mandela is using, and his group are using, this turn the other cheek. Having been imprisoned for 27 years, how do you get back and say, but let's look, let's work together, let's not have a separated situation? We wouldn't see that as a Christian witness coming out of a continent, that out of a situation. I see that as one of the witnesses. The Reconciliation of Peoples is a good book, and it has some interesting chapters. We think that these are the only ones because we got them just right now from the, and we will put them as the resources in the library here so people can have access to them if they want to read them. And finally, we want to make ourselves a little bit more available for people who want to have some informal discussions on these questions, because I know that there are lots of dilemmas that people have on Africa. I want to recommend to you also an article by Bishop Tutu, Africa's Dilemma, The Challenges and Possibilities. There's an article here written by Bishop Tutu and another one by Chipenda. Chipenda is the General Secretary of All African Council of Churches. And both of these articles deal with all these, our issues, our tribalism, our everything. And they speak from the view of the African church. And they are worth reading articles in these documents. And we put all these resources in the library. I want to thank you for coming. I think probably we won't discuss your question, but can you voice it up?
I was just going to ask. I read on the internet that in your country, Kenya, if you want to publish a newspaper or a magazine, that you basically had to have permission from the government and accept the party line. And I just wondered if that was really a true statement.
Yes, there is repression of press in my country presently, and our government does want to support only the people who agree with themselves, and that's why there is a protest from the people.
Yes.
Thank you very much for coming, and tomorrow we will be looking at issues that divide us in terms of gender and other things that divide us. Thank you very much for coming.